Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Next Tuesday, I've got special guest and friend and brother and fellow heathen, Aaron Raw. He's going to join me on the show, and we're going to talk about the pagan origins of many of our Christmas traditions. This is familiar territory, but December is always an opportune time to talk about it, especially in the wake of the annual Fox News war on Christmas. And, you know, I just thought it'd be fun to get Aaron's take on it. He loves to talk about the ancient gods, and I suspect he might be one. So he's going to join me next Tuesday. That's going to be a lot of fun. You know, December is always the month when people sort of get reinterested in New Testament studies. They get into the birth and life and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ as told by the New Testament. But, you know, how do we know the New Testament is authentic? And how do we know that the authors of the New Testament books were actually the authors? And of course, the short answer is we don't. And there's a fascinating exploration into the forgeries in the New Testament. This course is called Lost Christianities, Christian Scriptures, and the Battles Over Authentication. It's taught by Dr. Bart Ehrman at the Great Courses Plus. You know, when I was a true believer, I would have never thought, well, some of these might be fake or forged or written 100 years later, and somebody borrowed somebody else's name as author. But it's absolutely the case. And it's so interesting to see the New Testament dissected in this way. Of the 13 letters in the New Testament, in fact, six, the authorship of six are heavily disputed. Did you know there's a third Corinthians out there? I didn't know that, but it exists, and it's in a different canon of the New Testament. This is the kind of stuff he covers, and it's really worth your while. In fact, the Great Courses Plus has over 10,000 different lectures on a huge variety of subjects. And right now, you've got the chance to start enjoying this resource for free. For a limited time only, you can get a special free month of unlimited access to the Great Courses Plus. But to start your free month, you have to sign up using my special URL. Make it a Christmas gift to yourself. Sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. Today's show is actually the audio of a speech I've been giving around the country for the last several months. This is the recording from the Orlando version of it. It was sponsored by the Central Florida Freethought Community. There's a video link in the description box if you want to watch it on YouTube. But it was a lot of fun to give. We had a standing room only crowd in Orlando, and I hope you enjoy this sort of examination of how we as skeptics sometimes, no matter how hard we try, get tripped up by not-so-true stories. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy it. Thank you all so very much for the honor of being here, for the honor of the invitation, and for the chance to hang out with all of you godless heathens today. There is an old saying. It's actually attributed as a Chinese curse, but that's been disputed. The saying says, may you live in interesting times. Now, I don't know about you these days, but I kind of wish times were a lot less interesting. You feel that?
Yeah.
My first thought every morning when I log on to the internet is what? Damage report. How bad is the damage? What else has gone wrong? What fresh outrage is there to greet me today? And we mash at our keyboards and we add our voice to the cacophony of angry voices out there in the ether, hoping that our voice will be louder than the voices of the opposition. As that internet meme says so deftly, it says, cancel all my meetings, someone on the internet is wrong. Now, we've always had a problem with lies or half-truths disguising themselves as truth. But in the age of the internet, it's taken on a whole new flavor. It's a different animal in many ways. And before we realize, even as skeptics, before we realize that we've been duped, we're liking and sharing and liking and sharing with everybody we know. And I guess it's always been the case that we're, you know, we're human beings, flawed human beings, who have trouble balancing our own desires for justice against our biases, our ignorance, our tendency to knee-jerk ourselves into a tailspin. Here's a pre-internet example of this very thing. Anybody know who Stella Liebeck is? Well, let me tell you the story, and I'll bet the pieces start to come together. Stella Liebeck passed away 14 years ago at the age of 91. If you don't know her face, I'll bet you've heard her story. It was the 27th of February, 1992. Stella Liebeck was in a car, went through the drive-thru at a McDonald's in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Now we tracking? Okay. She wanted cream and sugar for the coffee. They didn't mix it at the McDonald's inside. They gave you the packets. And so they did so. They gave her the packets of the cream and the sugar. She spilled the coffee on her lap, burning her skin, and a lawsuit was brought against McDonald's. A jury awarded Stella Liebeck $2.9 million. And if you can accurately say so about the year 1992, this story went viral. Everybody was talking about it. The first reaction was most likely the obvious one. It's the reaction I had. You got to be shitting me. It's coffee. It's hot. Of course you got to be careful with it. Everybody with a brain knows this. The media lapped this story up. Everybody was talking about it. It went international. And then you saw things like this, a billboard that went up that called it Lawsuit Lotto. The Citizens Against Lawsuit Abuse said you can spill hot coffee and win millions. What a tremendous abuse of the courts, a ridiculous waste. The insanity of awarding millions of dollars to somebody who just couldn't handle coffee. And people cried out for tort reform. We need tort reform. We need it now. Many people not knowing what tort actually is. Of course, we know tort is a baked dish with, with a pastry base and a delicious filling. Tort reform. It talks to limiting the types of lawsuits that can be brought and limiting the amount of damages that can be awarded. Supposedly there to protect the system against abuse. Americans cried out, "This America, what happened to us? What happened to our spine? People can't even have coffee anymore without having an accident and abusing the system. It's time to take our country back." Anyone hearing this kind of rhetoric today? Got to take this country back. Suck it up, it's coffee. So many parasites are out there gaming the system. Of course, I couldn't tell you the victim's name. I couldn't tell you at the time where it happened. I really couldn't tell you the specifics about when it happened. All I knew were the bullet points that sent me into an overdrive of righteous indignation. Woman spills coffee on herself in a car, sues big corporation, and wins millions. Now, this information at face value is true. These are facts. But are they the story? Well, Stella Liebeck's injury was not the first. In fact, for the 10 years before this incident in 1992, there had been over 700 reported cases of burns due to McDonald's coffee, many resulting in terrible third-degree burns. 10 years, over 700 other reports. This was like the car that she was riding in. It's not actually Stella Liebeck's car, a 1989 Ford Probe. Didn't have any cup holders, so she was having to kind of juggle the coffee. And yes, I did say she was riding. She wasn't behind the wheel driving, juggling her coffee. She was in the passenger seat, and driving the car was her grandson, Cristiano. And they weren't actually driving. They weren't on the road because once they went through the drive-thru, they slipped into a parking space so that they were not endangering anybody on the road. They wanted to safely be able to get the cream and sugar in the coffee. They actually did it right. The average pot of coffee in our households is 150 to 160 degrees Fahrenheit. McDonald's policy at that time for their coffee temperature was 180 to 190. That is almost boiling. Now, I'm going to show you a few images of Stella Liebeck's burn injury. If you don't want to see these, that's totally fine. Avert your eyes. I will tell you when it's all safe to look back at the monitor. But for the moment, if you do not want to see these, this is the time to look away. When you and I think coffee burns, what do we think? Something like that. We've all done it. We've all done it. Been working in the kitchen or something. We got a coffee burn. This is not Stella Liebeck's injury. This is Stella Liebeck's injury. If you look at the next slide, this is up here, the strip where they harvested the skin for skin grafts. She was permanently disfigured. It's now safe to look back at the screen. I'm done with the burn photos for now, but I'm not done with the story. Was her first instinct to say, screw you guys, I'm going to sue you for every penny you've got? Nope. Here's what she did ask for. She said, I need $20,000 to help me cover my medical expenses, and I would like an agreement put in place that you will adjust the temperature of your coffee so nobody else out there gets hurt. McDonald's declined the offer. It was only in the face of this that Stella Liebeck filed the lawsuit against McDonald's. And when a jury saw the facts of the case, not the hyperbole, not the wild rumor and speculation, but the facts of the case, against the long history of McDonald's unchanging policy, they awarded her in compensation $160,000. But would $160,000 prompt a multi-billion-dollar corporation to change its policies after all this time? How do you motivate a corporation of that size to change its ways? You put in place a punitive damage. You hit them in the pocketbook, and that's exactly what the jury did, a punitive damage of $2.7 million. And Stella walked away a millionaire, right? Wrong again. The judge reduced her reward to $480,000. Reports are she walked away with even less. And yet, this poor woman who did nothing wrong had nationally become the poster child for frivolous lawsuits. Now, let's come back to these three points. These remain true. But are they the story? We had information, but did we have perspective? Here's another gem. Anybody remember this little piece of outrage from the Cubs game in July of this year? If you're not familiar with what I'm talking about, I'll walk you through it. It was the 21st of July, Wrigley Field. And this happened. I'm going to show you a video clip. It's going to play in real time, and then it's going to play in slow motion. And I'll kind of verbally walk you through what's happening. As a pro baseball player, there's a baseball on the ground. He tosses it to the boy. Slides under the chair. Okay, let's watch it again in slow motion. Little boy is expecting the baseball. As it's tossed his direction, it goes down under his chair, and this guy behind him grabs the ball, and instead of giving it to the boy, gives it to his wife. Cubs second baseman Javi Baez came to the rescue. He gave the boy a signed baseball, and all was right again with the universe, you know, except for the rat bastard who sat behind him who stole the baseball from a little boy at a ball game. In 12 seconds, that man had become a national villain. When we saw this in the Twitterverse, what was our reaction? Some bitch, can I believe that guy would take the ball from the little boy? Son of a bitch! God, somebody get his home address and put it online! Can't stand it! Injustice of it all! Motherfucker! Okay. So there's a YouTube page called Hot Sports. They posted the video clip I just showed you under the title, Terrible Grown Man Steals Foul Ball from Little Kid at Cubs Game. And when I screenshotted this like months ago, there were already hundreds of thousands of views. Now, had we taken a moment and paused, had we made sure that we didn't just have information, but we had perspective, what might we have discovered? Well, check the Twitter photo of the young boy who's holding the baseballs. Plural baseballs. There's the signed one right here. Hey, where'd this one come from? Where'd he get that second baseball? Well, this guy's name is Chuck Mikoff. He went on Twitter. He said, hey, the other ball the kid has was the one that same guy,
the evil villain guy caught and gave him before this. I was there. I was sitting right next to him. And this was verified by yet another guy named Jeff. I was sitting next to the boy. The same fan had helped him snag a ball a few innings before this. Man was there at Wrigley Field with his wife on the day of their wedding anniversary. It was the first time they'd ever been to Wrigley Field. And he presented that ball to his wife as a memento, a keepsake, but only after he had helped snag baseballs for that young boy and two other boys sitting in the area. So the headline, the true and fair headline, should actually be, generous guy snags balls for little kids at Cubs game. It's the headline we should have led with. Now, how many people saw the story and were outraged, and how many people saw the retraction and correction out there? Very few, I would think. They have information. Do they have perspective? I'm going to talk for a second about the Netflix documentary series Making a Murderer, Season 1. If you have not seen it and you want to be completely surprised, now is a great time for a bathroom break. You will not hurt my feelings. Because I'm going to give you a few spoilers. But honestly, I think that after you hear what I'm about to say, that it will make your viewing of Making a Murderer Season 1 even more compelling. And yes, I do plan to watch Season 2, okay? I'm going to lay out a very basic version of what the documentary is trying to say, all right? Stephen Avery. Now, this is Stephen Avery back in 1985, 23 years old. He went to prison for the rape of a Manitowoc County woman named Penny Ann Bernstein. He was convicted of rape, and he served 18 years in prison. But DNA evidence ultimately exonerated him. He was not the rapist. The rapist was actually the guy on the right here, Gregory Allen, a man who had past crimes of sexual assault. He'd been misidentified, and the police did some pretty terrible police work, some sloppy and inept police work. And they sent the wrong man to prison for 18 years. Stephen Avery was released in 2003. This is him at the time of his release. And he prepared a multi-million dollar lawsuit against the Manitowoc County, Wisconsin Police Department for essentially ruining his life. Okay? Well, the documentary essentially is implying that the embarrassed police department, embarrassed by the revelation of their ineptitude and the media scrutiny, and facing a $36 million lawsuit, framed Stephen Avery for a murder in 2005, 2 years after he'd gotten out of prison. The murder of this woman, 25-year-old Teresa Hallback. She worked for Auto Trader magazine, and she had gone to the salvage yard on Stephen Avery's property to shoot the photograph of a vehicle for sale. She was never seen again. This is a picture of the salvage yard where authorities found her car, her car keys, bones, blood, and other evidence on Stephen Avery's land. And the documentary strongly pushes the narrative that he was set up. He was set up by the cops. This is a conspiracy to make a murderer. They manufactured his guilt. Petitions were circulated all over the place in the wake of this documentary. Here's one that had over 500,000 signatures presented to then-President Barack Obama. The story caught fire. And this is understandable because it strikes all the major chords. It's great drama, it's a great conspiracy yarn, and it speaks to our sense of justice. It hits us where we live. We have information, but do we have perspective? At the end of that 10-hour documentary, I was among those clamoring for his release because I was, from watching the documentary, convinced that he had not done it. And several skeptics who saw me talking about it said, you might want to do a little more digging. So I did. This guy's name is Michael Griesbach. He's a Wisconsin prosecutor. He chronicled Avery's wrongful conviction back in the 80s for the rape he did not commit. And he wrote a book about it called The Innocent Killer, A Wrongful Conviction and Its Astonishing Aftermath. And he followed the second trial. He followed the murder trial. And he provided his findings in another book called Indefensible, The Missing Truth About Stephen Avery, Teresa Hallback, and Making a Murderer. He was watching the Netflix documentary, and as a prosecutor who was very familiar with the case, was amazed at what they had left out. Now, I'm going to show you a few examples of what he reveals, and this has been reported in Time and other journalistic outlets. And you can decide for yourself. It's not my job to convict or exonerate Stephen Avery. My point is larger than that. I'm talking about information versus perspective. Let me give you just a little more information. There's a part of the documentary where he talks about where he was hanging out with his buddies. They were just hanging around drinking. And there was the family cat. And he, you know, tossed him over the fire, and we were just being stupid, and he lit up, and, you know, it's one of those things. And he was essentially arrested for animal cruelty. What the documentary didn't tell you is that if you look at the paperwork for his crime of cruelty to animals in the police documentation, it was revealed that he didn't just toss a cat over a fire, but he first doused it with gas and oil. So he found the animal and he doused it with fuel, and only then, and when it escaped, he dragged it out and he essentially waited till it was dead. Marking, according to Griesbach, and I think he's correct, marking two of the most common psychological signposts for potential homicidal behavior. You have cruelty to animals and a fascination with fire. Instead, in that segment of Making a Murderer, the documentary filmmakers were busy talking about the fact that he had missed the birth of his daughter because he was in jail at the time. It told the story of his frustration with his cousin Sandra Morris, who'd been talking shit behind his back, and he was all pissed off, and yeah, he may have done some inappropriate things. Let me give you some specifics. The documentary really put her in an unflattering light. Glazed over were the fact that he had watched her movements for months. Often with binoculars, he would sometimes stand out in the pre-dawn road as she was driving off to work, and he would be absolutely, completely naked except for his shoes, masturbating as she drove by. He once jumped in front of her vehicle, and he rubbed himself on the hood of her car. January 3rd, 1985, 7 months before this mugshot was taken, Avery was already facing jail time. He had rammed his car into her vehicle as she drove past. He pulled out a gun, pointed it at her face, and was going to kidnap her. Only when she pled for the life of her toddler child, who would freeze in the car, did Avery let her go. The documentary had a hugely compelling segment about a blood vial. The narrative is that the cops had gone into the evidence room and broken the seal, and they had extracted some of Stephen Avery's blood so they could then place it at the crime scene, making a murderer. And so there's this amazing scene where they go through and they pull out the vial, and yes, oh yes, you do see the syringe prick on the top of the vial. Oh, it's the smoking gun. It's the smoking gun. What the documentary filmmakers did not tell you is that it would actually be more suspicious if the vial didn't have a syringe prick on the top of it, because that is how the blood is inserted into the vial in the first place. And we actually know who did it. A nurse named Marlene Kranitz testified that she's the one who extracted Stephen Avery's blood back in the 90s, and she is on record as being the one who put the blood in the vial. Here's some information that seems kind of important, disallowed by the judge in the murder trial of Teresa Halbach and brushed over by the filmmakers of Making a Murderer. Stephen Avery's niece reported to the Calumet County Police that her uncle had molested her when she was a teenager and threatened her and her family if she did not comply. An interview in 2006 had a 42-year-old woman who said that Avery had raped her when she was a teenager. The Wisconsin Department of Criminal Investigation recorded an interview with another teenager under a pseudonym, Melissa Hansen. She said Avery called her for sex the day before Teresa Halbach disappeared, and she hung up on him and said, "You're sick." Avery's wife, Lori, had spent several days at a local domestic violence shelter after several beatings from Avery. From prison, he sent letters to his kids saying that he was going to kill her and mutilate his wife. More allegations of abuse in 2006 when Avery's then-girlfriend Jody reported to the cops that he had often beaten her to bruises and strangled her to the point of unconsciousness. There's a recorded jail telephone conversation dated 27th of January 2006 where Avery says, "You need to lie about where you got the bruises. Don't tell them I did it. Tell the cops you simply fell down." Most explosively, perhaps, Jody Stokowski came forward in January of 2016, just after Making a Murderer released, and she told Headline News that she had lied to the documentary filmmakers because she was afraid for her life. She said, "I know the guy. I'm convinced he murdered Teresa Halbach after all." Yet for a time after I watched the documentary, I had joined the chorus of people who were clamoring for his immediate release because it's so unjust. Now again, guilty, innocent, this is a journey that we all have to take as skeptics and seekers of evidence. But there is more than the information provided by the documentary, and I encourage you all to take the journey on your own. Now, this one actually happened. We get trapped by bad information all the time as skeptics. Anyone think that skepticism or being an atheist is like an immunity from being unreasonable? Like, anyone think being an atheist or a skeptic is somehow keeps us from doing dumbass stuff? Oh, if it were true, but it's not. And here's a great example. This, of course, is NFL football player Colin Kaepernick. Now, he gained international attention when he attempted to draw attention to the abuse of power by police officers against black people. What he wanted to do is to draw attention by, instead of standing and saluting during the national anthem at football games, he would kneel. He would kneel. And this divided the country. I'm sure it divided the state of Florida, right? You have half the people saying, this is treason. This is disrespecting the flag and everyone who stands under it. It disrespects our military and our country. It's traitorous. It's awful. It's evil. And you have other people saying this is an important and necessary form of respectful protest in the wake of injustice and covered by the Constitution. And you have both sides clashing against each other. People still arguing about this today. In September, Nike made Colin Kaepernick its spokesperson. And conservatives who felt that this kneeling was treason lost their minds. And so in protest, what they did was they went into their closets and they got their Nike shoes and they took them out and set them on fire. Okay? I saw the story. I said, wait, they'd already purchased them? And then they burned them? They bought them and then they burned them. Okay, well, check out this story on Twitter, okay? This guy's name is Phil Braun. He tweets himself burning his shoes while he is still wearing them, okay? Now, I'm going to show you another burn photo, so prepare yourself, but you might want to see this one, okay? Afterwards, he tweets this. Phil Braun says, I am in the hospital. Now, I saw skeptics sharing this story left and right. This proves the damage done by all this wild conservative thinking. We knew they were idiots, but geez, can you believe that somebody would actually set? I can believe it. People are just that stupid. You should see this. And it's shared and shared and shared and shared and shared. If one person had stopped and taken a look at Phil Braun's profile, they would have realized he's a comedian and online prankster. And if they'd done a little more digging, they might have realized that this photo is a bit familiar, at least in the medical community, because if you go back a year and a half to a trauma website originating out of Australia, you would see the exact same photograph. Phil Braun trolled everybody, successfully trolled all of us on Twitter. I fell for this one. Crocodile kills Ethiopian pastor during lake baptism. Anybody else seen this story floating around? Okay. Well, the short version is that there's a pastor named Docho Ashete, and he's decided he's going to enjoy God's divine protection, so he and 80 of his congregants go out to a pond, a croc-invested lake or whatever, and they're going to have a baptism. And as he's baptizing people, a crocodile comes out and drags him off, and he's killed horribly, okay? And I talked about this story on the radio. Can you believe this? I mean, we knew religious thinking damaged people, but it's just insane. What a crazy world we live in. This is just another Darwin Award. You know, this is just the gene pool sorting itself out, isn't it? I mean, for the sake of, this is natural selection is what this is, right? Now, my buddy Hemet Mehta, Friendly Atheist, posted this article. No, an Ethiopian pastor didn't get eaten by a crocodile during a baptism. And he was right, because he was doing just some rudimentary examination of the story. 80 people there, nobody got a shot of a photograph, nobody got any video. The long history of this same story, apparently happening earlier in other places. It was only posted once by the BBC in kind of their tabloid section. Nobody else had reported it. The whole thing already refuted on Snopes if I had taken 10 seconds to look it up. But I eagerly jumped upon the story. I was all over it. Why? Because there are people on this planet who do demonstrate that level of stupidity every day. We've all seen the actual stories of things like this happening. But I should have known better. You know, I was biased. The story supported my position that religion damages people. I was in a hurry. I'm guilty. Friend sent me this, a guy named Nikolai. Did you fact check this before reposting? I don't need to. It agrees with my preconceived views and biases, so it must be true. Here's another one. Anyone seen this Coca-Cola thing floating around on the internet? Okay. Well, the text is much too small for you to read, but never fear. I'm just going to sort of run you through the basics, all right? And it's a warning about the dangers of drinking Coca-Cola, likely soft drinks in general. And it's got pharmacist in the website tag down here, so it must be true. And this went viral. I mean, it was being shared all over the place out there. Here's the general gist of the message. You drink a Coca-Cola, 10 teaspoons of sugar immediately enter your body. And your body has to stave off the reflex to vomit it back up, because even your body knows it's bad for you. And then your pupils will dilate, and your liver turns that sugar to fat, and then you get a caffeine high, a dopamine high. It's kind of like a heroin high, and your body excretes important calcium, and then you have that sugar crash. Coca-Cola is so terrible for you. Like, share. Because we know soft drinks are not health foods. It feels intuitive, doesn't it? So for the sake of humanity's health, we share because we care. We have information. Do we have perspective? Well, dietitian Heather Mangieri spoke to Live Science. She said it's not wholly inaccurate, but some of this wording is exaggerated. Does the liver turn that sugar to fat? Well, hang on. Not if you're energy starved or an extremely active person, then that sugar is likely burned for fuel and not turned into fat. Beware the caffeine in Coke, which amps up the body, although a can of Coke has less than half the caffeine of an 8-ounce cup of coffee. Is that dopamine kick really like a heroin high? That sounds ominous. Well, dopamine is actually also aligned with many healthy and worthy activities, like good music, massage, exercise, even sex. A natural high is often a very good and beneficial thing. You evacuate calcium, zinc, and magnesium that your bones could have benefited from, but we don't know if that happens because Coke drinkers drink Coke instead of milk. And what about the phosphoric acids found in everyday foods that are not Coca-Cola? We share because we care. How often are we sharing misinformation? Partial information or outright falsehoods. Time magazine published an article written by Casey Steinmetz. It talked about how even smart people can fall for this stuff. Our brains can be so easily tricked. It's not just stupid people that get tripped up. It can happen to anybody, often because we allow the wrong impulses to take over. The average American spends 24 hours a week online. 24 hours. And I think that may be a low number for some of us. We want likes. We want shares. We're social animals. Validation, it feels so good and often cheats our reasoning powers. Political convictions often lead to lazy thinking. But there's an even more fundamental impulse at play. It's the innate human desire for an easy answer. Time magazine in 2016 did an article called The Science of How Marketers Manipulate Us. Research says we get 5 times more information today than we did 30 years ago. 5 times. And as a result, because we're just surrounded by an avalanche of info, the pitches that seem to simplify the world that most easily fit in a cookie cutter, those are the ones that most resonate in the human brain. We're seeing this in the U.S. Midterm elections. Political Party A loves America. Political Party B hates America. I'm not making the false equivalence between one party or the other. I'm saying people often think in binary ways, dichotomous thinking. We're being manipulated, perhaps in ways we may not understand. Religions, causes, politicians, advertisers, communicators, storytellers, they're trying to set that hook and reel us in. They're playing to our human emotions, and we all have them. They play to our egos, trying to puff us up and make us feel important. That always feels good, enhancing our own perception of ourselves. They target our subconscious, affecting how we feel or process information, maybe without us even realizing it. And this can be done in almost countless ways, especially if you look at like online advertising. People can manipulate our perceptions with layouts, colors, fonts, font size, photographs, imagery. I'm a video producer, okay? And I could likely manipulate your perception of a video interviewee without even changing one thing they say. I'll show you kind of how I would do that. This guy's name is Muhammad El-Qadra. He is an ex-Islamist from Jordan, became an atheist, and he feared for his life. And he found asylum in the United States, and now he's a human rights activist. He's just a tremendous guy, and he's got an amazing story. And he's like the last video interview I'd done. I hope he doesn't mind me grabbing the screen capture. But I framed him on screen like you would normally frame an interview subject. If I wanted to manipulate your perception of Muhammad El-Qadra, I could do so as a videographer, potentially without changing anything that he says. I could use color or the lack of color. Now it's more harsh. It's a little more intense, perhaps threatening. I could put on a film filter with some film grain in it. Those are easily done digitally these days. I could change the color scheme so it looks like 70s Kodak film stock, and then you wouldn't know unless I told you whether the interview happened 30, 40 years ago or happened today. Video producers use what we call the rule of thirds. Now, you can play with the rules once you know them, and I've often done this, but the rule of thirds essentially goes like this. If I put Muhammad's head right here and call this empty space over here, call it lead space, okay? So I put him on this side of the screen. The general rule is that I want to put his eyes where the thirds of the screen intersect. So this is the third vertically, this is the third horizontally. I'd want to kind of put his eyes right about there. Just a nice, even framing of the subject. Video 101. Once you know the rule, then you can kind of turn it on its ear and get artistic and do some cool stuff. But I can also use the rule of thirds or work against it to perhaps manipulate your perceptions of my subject. I can drop him in the frame lower. So the third's up here, but he's lower, and if I'd shot it a little differently, I could have moved him back so he was further away. This subtly implies that he is overwhelmed by his surroundings. He is weaker. He is diminished. He's sinking in the frame. If I wanted to go for sort of an ominous look, well, I just go for the close-up. Now he's right up on you. This is subtly communicating something. If I wanted to add maybe a red hue around the side, it becomes even more intense. The storyteller has an agenda. I'm a storyteller, telling the story of my escape from superstitious thinking and hopefully encouraging others to make their escape as well. I have an agenda. All storytellers have an agenda. The challenge is, how do we tell those stories in an entertaining and compelling way without changing or cheating the facts? How do we watch and listen and read these stories without being taken advantage of? Everybody's got an angle. We're creatures of emotion as well as reason. We can all be manipulated. This is Ken Burns. He's a brilliant documentary filmmaker who's produced my favorite documentary of all time called The Civil War. He did a short clip, a video interview with The Atlantic called On Story. He talked about the storyteller and manipulation. Let me play you a short clip.
Jean-Luc Godard said, "Cinema is truth 24 times a second." Maybe it's lying 24 times a second, too. All the time. All story is manipulation. Is there acceptable manipulation? You bet. People say, "Oh boy, I was so moved to tears in your film." That's a good thing. I manipulated that. That's part of storytelling. I didn't do it disgenuinely, I did it sincerely. I am moved by that too. That's manipulation.
Everybody out there has an agenda. I have an agenda. I want to see people liberated from religious chains. I want to see us operating as humanists in this world because we don't believe that there is an afterlife. We don't believe there is a magician in heaven who's going to solve our problems. I have an agenda, but I can put that out there on the table and communicate in a way that doesn't cheat the facts and it doesn't cheat you as the viewer. One tactic for us protecting ourselves is to simply put reason in front of emotion. Unlike the church, when I was in the church, they always said, go with the flow, fake it till you make it. Do you feel the spirit? If you don't feel it, it's okay. One day you will feel it. But as creatures of reason as well as emotion, we try as best we can to put reason as the driving force and then put in place the scientific method and empirical evidence, these methods to help foolproof and sort of circumvent human biases. In my own life, I've had to slow down. Anybody else struggle with this? Slow down. Natalie's always telling me, slow down. I'm navigating so much, 250,000 people on Facebook and all these other, and the emails are coming in left and right. And, you know, I'm just kind of a one-man show. I find myself overwhelmed. I get in a hurry and she's like, slow down. And she's absolutely right. Am I getting the full story? Am I telling the full story? Have I read material about this sourced elsewhere? Have I looked at the legitimate criticisms of the story and the storytellers? Do I believe it because it confirms what I already think? Am I missing something? I have information. Do I have perspective? This guy's name is Dr. Robert Cialdini. He wrote a book that I'm almost finished with called Influence, the Psychology of Persuasion. It's a great resource for understanding how marketers and influencers study our brains so they can learn how to trick us, how to hook us, various tricks that bring us in. He talks about the six principles of persuasion. I'm not going to go through all of them in detail. The ones that relate most to us today, probably authority. Dr. Oz says this. Well, he's Dr. Oz. When you see him on TV, what's he wearing? Doctor's clothing. Some of those guys, TV doctors, wearing a stethoscope on television. You know they have no need for a stethoscope. But they are communicating, I'm an authority, you can trust me. Deepak Chopra has a PhD, right? We see apologists, we see people of all shapes and stripes saying, I'm an authority on this subject. You can trust me. I have divine revelation. You can trust me. I remember once we had an advertiser when I was in radio. He was a naturopathic doctor, which is no doctor at all. And we would do live broadcast. And you know what he wore during the live broadcast? He wore spectacles and a lab coat, a white lab coat. He didn't wear glasses. But he wore the spectacles and lab coat because it communicated that he's an authority. I'm a doctor of naturopathy. Consistency is another interesting one I thought was. Human beings don't want to look flaky. We don't want to look like flakes. Changing our mind becomes problematic for people who don't want to look shifty or on unsure footing. So there is a tendency for people to stick with an original choice even when they realize it's not the best choice because they'd rather appear consistent than be correct. It's an interesting human tendency. And then consensus. How could millions of people be wrong about vaccines causing autism? Millions of people believe it. They can't all be wrong. Authority. It's an interesting book, and it's a great resource for understanding how people target the human brain. Here's the encouraging thing that I genuinely think is the sort of the silver lining around this cloud, and it's what I want to leave you with here at the end of the presentation. I genuinely think that our trip-ups come from a good place. I think the reason we get tricked is because we genuinely do want justice to prevail over injustice. because we're upset about the insanity in the world, and we see something that's just crazy and damaging and terrible, and we want people to know about it. We want to expose it so that it can be eliminated, defeated. It can be wiped off the table so the world might be a better place. Many of us, so many of us, are operating from a point of goodness. We share because we care. It's a nuts world out there. We simply want to make it less so. And we get it wrong from time to time. We'll make a mistake. I'll make a mistake. We eat the crow. We apologize. We print the retraction. The important thing is that we keep our eyes open and be aware that we can be tricked and that everybody has an agenda and that it's often best to hit the pause button. Slow down, take a breath, realize that in this information crazy world, we are not wired to handle all of it. Anybody else ever feel overwhelmed? So then you end up reading the headline, the first three sentences, and you move on. You move on. You move on. We all feel like I don't have enough hours in the day. I don't have enough bandwidth to handle everything that they're throwing at me. And so we take shortcuts. Being aware of that helps to protect ourselves against it. Let's take our breath. Let's take a second. Let's look around. Let's do some homework. Let's make sure we don't just have information. Let's make sure we have perspective. And I think if we can do that and root ourselves in the legitimate and the credible, we genuinely can make a better world. Thank you all very much for having me on today.
The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on the Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.